There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome once again to Football Belongs. I'm Richard Bayliss. Before we get into episode 3, just a reminder, the written chapter for the topic of The Legend of Anzac is on the Optus Sport app and sport.optus.com.au right now. The podcast and chapter are different to each other, so we recommend you listen and read to get the full experience, in whichever order suits you. For now, though, it's over to your host, David Davutovich.
Thanks, Richard. Yes, we've already heard from some of the biggest Australian football names in the opening podcast episodes of Football Belongs, starting with a scene setter before we delved into the themes of multiculturalism through a football lens. The epic Socceroos v Croatia match at the 2006 World Cup and the not-so-classic Socceroos AC Milan clash of 93 were the games in focus, plus a tour that never was. I strongly recommend you do take a listen after you complete this one because it is a beauty. Have you ever wondered why football is sidelined during Anzac commemorations? Did you know that entire football teams were killed on European battlefields in World War One? In this episode, we focus on the legend of Anzac through the lens of Australia's 1967 tour of Saigon, where 18 Australian footballers were dropped right into the heart of a raging war zone as a diplomatic envoy and claimed the Socceroos' first ever international trophy. Joining me as always is author and series creator John Didelitzer, who made 27 NSL appearances for Melbourne Knights and Sydney United before serving as FFA legal counsel, Melbourne City football director and chief executive of the Australian Football Players Union, the PFA. Another very special guest in Socceroos legend Ray Barts, who's recognised as among the most brilliant players Australia's produced and was part of that infamous tour of Saigon. And Victoria University Literary Studies lecturer and academic Ian Sison, who's written about football's Anzac connections in his book, The Game That Never Happened, The Vanishing History of Soccer in Australia. John Didelitzer, I'll start with you as the author and creator of the series. The specific match you refer to is Australia's 3-2 win over South Korea in the final of the 1967 National Day Football Tournament. Why is it so significant in an Anzac context?
Yeah, I think there's probably three dimensions to this, David. This whole entire series is about trying to understand the essence of Australia and then putting a footballing lens over that. And there's probably three key areas that I think are worthy of discussion. And the first of those is the role of the legend of Anzac in Australia. And I think most of us have got an awareness of what that is. But, you know, it was born as a day of national significance on 25 April 1915, when Anzac soldiers landed within the Ottoman Empire on a peninsula known as Gallipoli. And, you know, just reading some quotes from that time, they talk about the stench from rotting corpses putting soldiers through an almost impossible trial, to the sun setting on 15 mortal hours. The Australian and New Zealanders occupied the heights under the incessant shell fire. And without the support of a single gun from the shore. So this crucible of Australian mythology since that time has really existed on two planes. One is this ritualistic recognition that happens on the 25th of April every year, where we have a public holiday and do the rituals that accompany that day.
Mm-hmm.
But the second part is this second plane, which is this nebulous thread of Australian identity that it created, the Anzac spirit, and that's evolved over decades and into a new century. And that's really what we need to unpack as a part of this. Now, why Gallipoli was such a significant moment is multi-layered, but just in terms of sheer numbers, about 50,000 Australian troops landed on Turkish soil, of which just over 8,000 were killed and a further almost 18,000 were wounded. And a comment from the Times says, amid the profound destruction, we find an act of national creation. So it sits in many ways at the heart of, or we'd like it to sit at the heart of what it means to be Australian. Sir William Dean, who was the Governor General of Australia in the late 90s, would say, though born from the doom campaign at Gallipoli, the spirit of Anzac is not really about loss at all. It is about courage and endurance and duty and love of country and mateship and good humour and the survival of a sense of self-worth and decency in the face of dreadful odds. So there's been this religious transcendence that just goes well beyond mere commemoration of Anzac. Mm-hmm. It's gone from a ritualistic expression of remembrance to a framework of ideals and of values that characterise the way Australians should aspire to live their lives. And within that thread, that thread has intersected with football on innumerable instances throughout Australia's history since Federation. We'll talk a little bit about, as you mentioned, some of the teams like Ilrimple and Caledonia, who were, in the case of Ilrimple, cancelled as a consequence of their troops' commitment to World War One. But moreover, we'll talk about the 1967 Socceroos tournament, the National Day tournament in Saigon.
During a tour of Asia, Australian soccer players made a clean sweep, winning the Saigon Asian tournament.
The Johnny Warren described the final as the best game that Australia's ever played. And we had a bunch of 20-somethings heading to Saigon as Australian envoys to represent our nation in that context, which is an incredible story.
It was always smart, we'll send the soccer, if we lose a few of the Sheilas, Wogs and Poofters, it won't matter, you know, that sort of attitude. And it was a fabulous experience, and that's where we were born. That was the basis of the team which eventually qualified for Germany 7 years later.
And the third part is this modern commercialisation of this Anzac spirit, if you like, and how in many ways that commercialisation has sidelined football's role as a part of this this Anzac spirit, if you like, or this transcendence that Anzac's had through Australian society, that our inability to actually tell our story now through the commercial lens through which Anzac Day is commemorated.
We're going to get our teeth into all of those topics, some fascinating threads there, but Ray Barts, you were one of the players on that tour, capped 48 times by the Socceroos, scoring 18 goals. Your career ended prematurely, age 27, after a savage blow to the neck from a Uruguayan opponent in a 1974 World Cup qualifier. 9 years earlier, you're at Manchester United in their academy, signed a first-team contract, and you only returned to your native Newcastle in New South Wales, that is, due to homesickness. Now, it's an absolute honour to have you on, Ray. We'd love you to paint a picture of this 1967 tour for us.
Thanks a lot, Dave. It's a long time ago. You know, the memory is a bit vague on a number of things, but the team that was picked to go to Vietnam was a follow-up. We played three games earlier in the year against Scotland, and there was a more senior Australian team picked for those three games. A number of those boys were unavailable for a number of reasons later in the year or didn't want to go on the tour of Saigon. It was probably not the most attractive place to go to at the time, you know, with the war going on there.
Travelling with the team was the ABC soccer commentator Martin Royal. Martin, what was it like?
Well, Bill, the time's pretty horrible, but not all the time. We had a lot of fun. We had a lot of happy moments, and we came back with some very happy memories. We were, of course, a winning team. But in Saigon, and when you consider a team playing night after night in front of a crowd, sometimes up to 35,000, very partial towards Australia, I might say, with one exception when we played against Vietnam. When you've got armed guards, scores of armed guards parading the ground constantly with automatic rifles at the ready, when you can see the flashes and hear the sound of heavy gunfire, sometimes not more than 2 or 3 miles away, during a match. These are obviously not ideal conditions for football.
But the team was picked. It was a team with an average age of only 23. I was only 20 years of age. And, you know, we had no hesitation in going to Saigon. We really didn't know what we were going into. At no stage did we ever feel we were being dropped right bang in the middle of the war zone or anything like that. It wasn't until we landed in Saigon and saw the might of the American Air Force at the airfield in Saigon that we realised where we were and what we're in for. You know, the greeting there was fantastic. The Vietnamese people were very hospitable and very friendly. They put on a bus to take us to a hotel. The bus had a police escort the whole way, with sirens blaring and everything, to the hotel. Once we got there, you could say the hotel was very basic. No air conditioning, of course. The food that was supplied was unedible. You couldn't drink the water. So virtually for 3 days, we lived on Coca-Cola and bread rolls. So it wasn't, in the middle of a war zone, oppressive heat and humidity, it wasn't the best preparation for any international football games, you know, but once we...
Playing games every 2 days, mind you.
Yeah, and then training in between on a field that was just caked in mud, with the police escort to the training field. Wherever we go, we're aware of, you know, not venturing too far from the hotel. Our trips to the stadium each day were once again with the police escort in the bus, and then once we got to the stadium, there was soldiers going around the stadium with mine detectors under all the cars, under the bus, and make sure there was no nasties hanging around before we even got into the stadium. So, as I said, you know, the games were tough, but the preparation didn't sort of, you know, enlighten things at all. But it was a tremendous team spirit. You know, I think you develop team spirit and camaraderie under difficult circumstances. And one thing the coach at the time, Uncle Joe Vlasic, had the reputation for was building team spirit. And he built a team spirit that, you know, I think laid the foundation for the term the Socceroos, and certainly for the spirit of the Socceroos on that tour.
Yeah, we'll touch more on the spirit of the Socceroos later on, but I wanted to introduce Ian Syson, the author of The Game That Never Happened. You wrote about the First World War's crippling effect on the trajectory of soccer in Australia. What are your views on football or soccer's connection with Australia's military history and the legend of Anzac?
Well, soccer has got a strong link with the Australian military, and it's for a variety of reasons. One of them is the officers who in the army were often trained in Britain, although sometimes they were British, and they had a preference for British football games, so rugby and soccer were their preferences. So that's one thing. But at the same time, a lot of the people who went into the army were soccer players, and so it's And that's a much ignored fact, I think. So we go back to the Boer War, Australian soccer players went there, and we go to the First World War, and Australian soccer players enlisted with gusto. It was remarkable, and as John's already mentioned, a number of clubs were virtually cancelled by their participation in the war. So many of their players died, and competitions all around Australia stopped, and so it was the war had a drastic effect on the development of soccer as well. Moving to the Second World War, a similar story occurs. It's we go, you know, the game is there all of the way. Now I know this stuff because I was triggered by a comment on a discussion board, which poo-pooed the idea that the Australian armed forces would have any interest in soccer. You know, the guy suggesting it said that it was just absurd to think that people might sit around the bar talking about soccer. And so I thought, well, rather than just react to it, I'll investigate. And I basically ended up on this course of understanding this history quite deeply. And so And I wish I could find that person and have a chat with them. So, well, actually, it's there's quite a strong relationship. And however, that comment has a basis, doesn't it? It has a basis in the general ignorance of the relationship between Australian soccer and the armed forces. And I think Ray's experience, if that was a rugby league team, if that was an Australian rules team, that experience would be elevated to the height of courage and bravery and cultural significance. It's a soccer team. It's kind of unable to be categorised. We don't know what to do with it. I just wish that, you know, this story was more and more known, because it's a really important one.
On that point, I want to read out the Australian or Socceroos team sheet from that 1967 final in a moment, but I just want to set the scene with John Didelitzer. So you're the CEO of W Sports and Media. You represent athletes and Olympians from a variety of sports. So your sporting repertoire expands well beyond the round ball code. With that in mind, let's have a listen of the team sheet on that day. Ron Corrie, George Keith, Stan Ackerley, Manfred Schaefer, Dick Van Elfen, Alan Westwater, Tommy McCall, Adi Abonyi, Johnny Warren, the captain, Ray Bartz, and Billy Vojtek. Those names are largely anonymous, John, in Australia, both in a football in some ways, but more so in an Australian sports context. Why is that so?
Yeah, I think it's an important observation, David, that it's not only that a lot of these names are invisible in the mainstream, they're actually invisible within our football community. So that's something we need to get exceedingly more accomplished at, is taking ownership of these stories and really driving these stories. But it does contrast. In researching this, what was quite confronting or certainly jarring was the elevated esteem we might give to athletes across other sports who might perform great deeds on the pitch in Anzac Day games. Mm-hmm. You know, they enhance their legend by having 32 possessions against Essendon and being granted the Anzac Day medal at the MCG.
Tarawa, who's our favourite to win the Anzac medal.
And the winner of the Anzac Day medal is Adam Tarawa of the Collingwood Football Club.
The tradition continues. Takiaho has got it. And he strides away. Takiaho. He puts a seal on the Anzac Day game.
Whereas here we have young men in the average age of that squad, I think, David, was 23.
23. So basically the Oliru squad was sent over to a war zone.
This is a bunch of young guys who were just probably straight out of a trade or taken off the shop floor at a factory and dropped in Saigon. And as Ray will no doubt detail later on, put through the most incredible experience for the best part of a few weeks. And their recognition is zero. They have no capacity or no platform to tell this story. They're not handed, and Ian made the point of these stories aren't handed from one generation to the next. And it's incredibly sad. It's incredibly sad that we know that certain players may have won 3 Anzac Day medals at the MCG, but we don't know that 18 young guys were dropped into that war zone and risked their lives.
Mm-hmm. Ray, I just wanted to clarify something. Speaking of historical records, they do differ as to the goal scorer in the final, the scorer of the first goal. What we do know is that it was an incredible solo effort, as John refers to in his chapter.
Johnny Warren scored the first goal. The second goal.
Second goal, okay. Yeah. All right. Was the second goal scored by you, Ray Bartz, or was it Billy Vojtek?
To be honest with you, David, I can't remember.
That means Billy scored it.
It could have been, but it really didn't matter, because, you know, we were a team, and we were a team spirit, and we all, you know, fought for one another. And, you know, we may not have had the individual skill of the South Koreans or whatever, but we had the Anzac spirit, I think, you know, as we've spoken about, and we had the will to win. And, you know, whoever scored the goal, it was a team effort and didn't matter. But no, I think I scored it, mate.
Hey, no doubt about the semi-final goal. It was a solitary goal you scored in extra time, no less. Can you talk us through that one?
Well, the we played in the conditions the whole way through the tournament were very heavy. You know, there was a lot of rain. The ground was muddy. There were so many. You know, all the games were played on the one ground, by the way. So you can imagine the state of the ground by the time we got to the final after 2 weeks. There was an enormous amount of games. So it was like playing in a quagmire. And they talk about, you know, Frank Michik at the time was the best player in Victoria, and he was a very skillful, silky sort of player. Frank played the first game over there, but because of the conditions, never played another game. They just didn't suit him, and he never got another opportunity, unfortunately. But, you know, by the time we got to the final, the ground was heavy, and, you know, I think the ball from memory just landed at my feet around. I used to like to pick up a ball around the edge of the penalty box and just hammer it as hard as I could and hope for the best, and it just, you know, went in, and, you know, it was a tremendous feeling at the time.
Ray, can you tell us about the fight after the game? Is it true that the military police had to intervene to break up the teams?
There was a bit of pushing and shoving and whatever, but nothing any serious. The South Koreans had a are we talking about the
Malaysia game? Apparently, the Malaysia game. Yeah.
Oh, that, you know, I think it was, you know, our team was in the conditions. A lot of the tackles were probably a little bit late, you know, because of the conditions and so forth. And our team was probably a bit bigger and a little bit more physical, and, you know, they hadn't experienced those sort of games and against those sort of players, because there wasn't a lot of touring European teams going to Asia in that era, so they resented a lot of the tackles, and, you know, which weren't unfair, but they were just physical. And at the end of the game, some of the emotions just blew over a little bit more than normal.
You're very modest, Ray. I want to pick up on a point that Ian made earlier regarding Australia's or football's role in an Australian military sense. And I wanted to talk to something that goes to the heart of this Anzac spirit that John writes about and that he mentioned, the great mateship and camaraderie between the Socceroos and the Australian soldiers right throughout that 1967 tour. Can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, the whole idea of us going there in the first place was a PR exercise. It was called the Saigon Friendship Tournament, you know, for one reason or another. And all the countries that were unified in the fight against the North Vietnamese were represented in the tournament. So it was going into a tournament that we didn't really know a lot about, and we didn't know what to expect. But after 3 days not being able to eat the food and drink the water, a few of the army boys who were stationed over there that some of the local guys knew, I think Ronnie Corrie knew some boys that played with Canterbury and that, for instance, and they used to come and hang around the hotel a little bit, and then they realised, you know, how tough we were doing it, and they'd organise with their superiors to, you know, supply some steak and some milk and whatever, which was honestly a lifesaver at that stage. And then we got the invitation to go to the Australian headquarters in Saigon. The bus would be supplied with the police escort. We go down there and have a feed there, which was a great break to get away from the hotel, because it was pretty basic, as I said before. And we could have a game of snooker or do whatever we want, and to get away for a couple of hours and have some decent food was fantastic. But I might admit that the base was right in the centre of downtown Saigon. There was a sandbagged bunker type thing out the front of that with armed soldiers in that. And if a car pulled up within 50 metres of it, they would fire a warning shot. They would fire another one if it didn't move, and if it didn't move again, the next shot was fired at that car. And quite often when we were inside the hotel, we heard the guns going off two or three times. So it was a little bit unnerving at the time, but the good food made up for it well and truly.
Ian, I'll throw it back to you, and I guess just off the back of Ray's comments, now that he's painted a real picture for us of this tour, and a point that you wanted to make about the ordinariness of this.
Yeah, well, it's soccer has the problem, the general problem of seeming alien, seeming foreign, seeming that it doesn't quite belong in Australia. And the point I would make is that many of these soccer players who enlisted in the Australian Armed Forces in both wars, in the Boer War, were just ordinary people, ordinary Australians. And when you read their biographies, their little biographies, when they're mentioned in the newspapers, you realise that they're just, you know, they're just so ordinary. It's not funny. It's
and you've got some examples of that.
Well, I do have some examples. I've got I prepared a list of soldiers who were killed in the First World War. I found seven soldiers whose death notices were in the various papers. This one's from Adelaide, Private A.L. Gin of the 27th Battalion. He was killed in action in France on August 29. He was only 24 years of age and was a prominent athlete, a member of the Sir James Ferguson, Hawthorn and Adelaide Cricket Club, South Adelaide Football Club, and a champion soccer player. He worked for Messrs. Thompson and Harvey, where he was highly esteemed by a large circle of friends. This is not a special biography. This is just an ordinary person, even though he's quite a good sportsman across a number of sports. In Brisbane, the friends of Mr. and Mrs. Homer of Indooroopilly will regret to learn that they've received a cable message from one of their sons at the front stating that his brother Harry had died suddenly of illness, the Dardanelles. Okay, the deceased was well known in sporting circles, having been a keen soccer football player. At the time of leaving for the front, he was captain of the Indooroopilly CV Cricket Club. Just a regular guy. A telegram was, this is from Geraldton in Western Australia. A telegram was received by Dean Drain yesterday, conveying the news that Private J. Allen had been killed at the Dardanelles. Private Allen, with his brother Sergeant Vince Allen, volunteered with the first contingent from Geraldton. Deceased was about 21 or 22 years of age, was engaged on the jetty. He worked on the jetty. He's very popular and was a member of the Thistle Football Club. Mm. The number of people who played for Thistle football clubs around Australia who were killed is just phenomenal. I mean, that says something about the proclivities of Scots Protestants to join the army, I guess. It's interesting. Wollongong. I've got Melbourne. I've got Launceston. This one, I'll read the Launceston one out because this is really interesting. It's been officially reported to Mrs. Waters of 32 Canning Street that Corporal R. Gordon Powell of the 26th Battalion has been missing since August 5th. That usually means killed. Corporal Powell was a well-known central harrier and a member of the Elfin Soccer Club. The Elfin Soccer Club enlisted holus bolus. Every member of that club enlisted and went off. And that's a club in Lost Launceston. It actually reunited after the war and restarted. So not too many of them were killed. Only a few were killed.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So it was an extraordinary tour from a Socceroos viewpoint. 10 wins in 10 games, national headlines. In Australia, received a hero's welcome upon returning to Sydney Airport.
Last night at Mascot Airport, there was a reception which, according to one official, was the biggest thing since the Beatles. It was the welcome to the Australian soccer team, which has just returned home with the Vietnam National Day Cup and a record of 10 victories in 10 matches on their Asian tour.
Johnny Warren said the tour was a real national milestone, obviously headlined by that final. John, can I get you to talk to the significance of that match and that tournament from a football viewpoint?
Yeah, I think you said earlier, Dave, there was 10 games and 10 wins and our first ever international trophy. So purely on a footballing level, it's worthy of merit and one of our great achievements. But the fact that it occurred in the context that it did just adds so much more. And, you know, one of the, you know, we all love the, I certainly grew up with Johnny Warren. And for me, he was a real hero. As I, you know, matured into a young man who loved football, but moreover loved the context in which football operated or the universe that it inhabited or built. And I can't help but think how influenced Johnny would have been about football through that tour and seeing the powerful impact that football could have on so many people.
No Australian team would ever put up with those conditions, without any doubt, now. And there was no alternative. But against that, that also bonded the team. They had to be very, very good, get on well with each other and help each other, and they did.
you know, he was a guy born, you know, in Randwick, not predisposed to football in any way, didn't have a background of being involved in football. But he would evolve to become probably the person, I think, that straddled the two worlds of Australia more deeply than anyone. So he was somebody who was the kid from suburban Sydney, so he had one foot in that camp. But he had another foot in this footballing universe. And that's something that as a code we've never been able to do effectively, to transition across from one to the other, from how do we become, why are we always separate from mainstream Australia? And that was Johnny's great mission, to explain to people that this game wasn't merely about, it didn't belong in one quadrant or one section of Australian society, but it actually reflected who we were. And that was borne out by the names of the players who went on that tour that you read out earlier. This was the changing face of Australia. We had a lot of children of migrants who had come post-World War II into Australia. And Ray spoke about how this was the crucible or the catalyst for the Socceroos name. And it was that because for the first time, we had a national team who represented the changing face of Australia. And to this day, the Socceroos and the Matildas, I think, do that more effectively than any other team. And that sort of happened in 67. And then you have this journey for Johnny, understanding that at the time, seeing that, and then spending his whole life, as a great advocate as to how football can make us the most effective nation that we need to be. And there's no doubt that that trip to Saigon shapes that thinking. It's no doubt that he then comes home to Australia and continues to preach in that way because of those experiences. And that's had such a huge impact on so many people's lives. You know, the nation crying with him when we failed to qualify for the 1997 World Cup, and this interdependency that he preached about football success and Australia being able to successfully emerge from behind the colonial curtain. And these sorts of stories clearly would have shaped that thinking.
Absolutely. And even later in life, and we know you mentioned how passionate Johnny Warren was about Australian football. Even later in life, he listed this as one of the best games Australia has ever played. And I'll read you an excerpt from Johnny Warren, but it's referenced in your chapter, John Didelitzer. Quote, "I often say that the team should march in the Anzac Day parade because of the role we played in the war. Even the entertainers that toured Vietnam were in a controlled situation at the Australian bases, while we were right in the middle of the action. Here we were, a bunch of young kids who were expected to play soccer while a major war raged around us. I don't think the team has ever received the recognition it deserved for its war efforts. The tournament in Vietnam is so special to the guys involved and is permanently connected to the birth of the team that later became known as the Socceroos." There you have it, in Johnny Warren's words. I'll throw it over to you, Ray Bartz, to, I guess, take that further.
Well, you've got to set the scene before the tour. You know, 2 years earlier, we played our first World Cup qualifying campaign against North Korea. We were hammered in that campaign.
I call it the Australian sporting Gallipoli of not having a clue where we were going, walking into a trap of a Korean team, which ended up finished up in the quarterfinals of the World Cup, when there were only 16 teams qualified.
As a result, you know, we sort of looked to say, well, what can we do better? Johnny was appointed captain for the first time on this tour of Vietnam. Johnny Warren was only 24 years of age at the time. And, you know, we talk about the team spirit and the mateship, you know, that was developed on that tour. And most of that team spirit was, you can revert that back to Johnny's captaincy. You know, Johnny led by example, both off the field and on the field. And, you know, there's nobody that put in more effort, you know, in any game than what Johnny did. He talks about the service medal that the entertainers received for going to Vietnam. We never asked for or received any compensation or reward or anything going over there. I was 20 years of age. A lot of my mates had been conscripted and they were over there fighting. They were out in the middle of the jungles and whatever. So, you know, my reward was to be there to entertain, you know, whatever troops were around there and to give as much as we could. and to represent Australia. You know, it was always an honour. And I might say that after the win against South Korea in the final, which was one of the toughest games I've ever played in, and in Johnny's words, one of our best ever performances, the next day we went to Vung Tau to at the request of the troops down there where the main army base was. And, you know, we played a game against the troops down there in Vung Tau, right in the thick of it all. And, you know, that was more satisfying and to mingle with the guys that are over there than anything. So, you know, all in all, it was a tough tour, but it was, you know, a very rewarding and very satisfying tour.
Just to bring it back to the final, now crowd estimates ranging anywhere from 35 to 65,000. I'm not sure if you've got an estimate on how many people were there, Ray, but this goes to the heart of the Anzac spirit. So the Socceroos, you players, were told pre-game that the stadium could not absorb any more fans. So Australian troops who had supported you guys from the outset were locked out. You guys were incensed. You took a stand and said, no Aussie troops, no match. And soon enough, the seats became available. Can you just expand on that story?
Well, that was basically it in a nutshell, Dave. You know, when we found out that the troops that had, you know, supported us so much over the last 2 weeks weren't going to be allowed into the stadium, there was no seats available. We said, well, look, hang on a minute. You know, we're not playing unless these guys can get in here. You know, this is what we're here for. And, you know, in the last minute, they decided to let the troops in and sat them around the perimeter of the ground, at ground level, down on the, no seats, but just basically on the ground around the, and we knew they were there. You know, they couldn't have sat in a better spot, to be honest with you. So it was a tremendous boost for us and, you know, a tremendous shot in the arm before the game to know that they were there supporting us.
VIP seats these days, they'd be expensive tickets.
I love this story. I love that part of it. I also love the trip to Vung Tau when you played against the troops, because these are moments that make the myth fall apart. Mm. The myth fall apart that the Australian Army has nothing to do with soccer, or the Australian Armed Forces have nothing to do with soccer. When in fact, you talked about mates in the Army who'd played for Canterbury in Sydney. You talked... Your conscripted mates, I'm sure some of them were soccer players.
They all were,
yeah. And it's like, you know, this. Where did this go? Where did this information go? And it's you've got it, Ray. That's great that you've got it. But where did this information go to disappear?
Yeah, I think a lot of that, Ian, comes back. You know, I'll take your role here, David, and segue to another section of this is the inability of Australian football to become institutionalised. Mm. So you look at the key institutions, the key cultural monoliths of our society, and football plays little to no role in any of those. And you talk really effectively about this post-World War One, and how when these troops that went off to World War One, and we spoke about the team just outside of Mildura called Ilrimple, who lost eight or, I think, nine. Basically as a consequence of the deaths they suffered through World War One, there was no football team in Ilrimple until the 1970s, where I think a Croatian team came up in the 70s. So they had 60 years, 65 years without football as a consequence of World War One. You had Caledonia, who lost effectively their entire team or a large part of it, and had a few years to regroup before they could start playing football again. And notably, there was no break to the VFL season during those years. There was no break to not the NRL then, but the state-based rugby league competition, that they continued as normal, whereas every single soccer competition was brought to an end.
Yeah.
So we come back, the football players come back to start playing their game again, and they find a nation that effectively closes them out from access to facilities and a range of other things.
It's one of those periodic resets that soccer has. You know, I've talked about that in other forums where, you know, we're being asked to reset again. But in fact, let's not reset. Let's actually go back and kind of recover that history that we have.
And you delved into it, John, post-World War One, for instance. You reference in the chapter how soccer was warmly received back into Melbourne in the post-war years and even played at the MCG in 1920 and 1925 with great success and cooperation from the VFL, but didn't expand much beyond that. And that was obviously replicated or fairly consistent around the country. Can you just expand on that?
Yeah, I think Ian's probably better positioned to speak with some authority on that. But certainly there's, you know, pencils were sharpened to write against the game at every opportunity. So there was this acquiescence to football, provided it didn't pose a threat to the established forces of the time.
This is 100 years ago.
Yeah, so yeah, correct. And we have, as you pointed out, David, there was games at the MCG that were, you know, incredibly successful. But you have situations where in Adelaide and in Hobart where they refused access to state-owned facilities. AFL, at the time, Aussie Rules tenants refused access to state-owned facilities to football. And there's some commentary on that in Hobart in particular, where they say that why should we let the game that had no involvement in our war effort now take the place of our brave Aussie Rules footballers?
Well, it says that by implication, because what it says is that a game, you know, Aussie Rules is a game that, that shed blood for this country. And so we should have access to these sporting facilities as if no other game did the same thing. You know, and obviously Australian rules players joined up and went to war. You know, wouldn't try to say that wasn't the case at all. But it's the way that we get shoved out. And that letter you're talking about is a perfect example. And I think in the late 20s, the VFL gets on a war footing. It starts to see the problem. It starts to see that soccer is becoming a threat. Soccer is becoming, you know, quite powerful. It's booming at the time. And so it starts to reassert itself. It starts to regenerate its propaganda campaigns. It openly admits that it involved in propaganda campaigns. You know, and soccer, in its usual way, cooperates by splitting all around Australia at the same time. But, you know, the splits are, you know, possibly a product of that other kind of pressure as well. So, that's a whole other story, though.
I want to bring it forward a little bit now. So in your chapter, John Didlitzer, you reference Bob Hawke, who became Prime Minister in 1983, and how he took up ANZAC as a means of building bridges with Vietnam veterans who were, quote, dissatisfied with their treatment by government and wider public after returning from war. Now, can you just elaborate on how this commercialisation has affected football?
Yeah, I think just to run through some of the ebbs and flows of history is from the research that I did, and there's some fantastic literature out there that speaks to these sorts of things. But there was a real reset, to use your words, Ian, around the mythology that surrounded Anzac Day under the Prime Ministership of Bob Hawke.
This was really the birthplace, I think, of our spirit of nationhood.
He was the first PM to speak of making a pilgrimage to Gallipoli, and that was very much to try and, as a reaction to many of the Vietnam vets who had been treated poorly or neglected in their return to Australia. I think it's an important caveat to say we're not making judgments about the valour or otherwise of war here. This is a political decision made by Hawke to try and bring together what appeared to be a disenfranchised group. So he started investing significant more time and political capital in building the ANZAC mythology. And at the point, football, at that stage, football clearly didn't have a strong leg up in many of the institutions within Australia. So other parts of the Australian community were accelerated ahead of where football was. I'll just read you out a statement from Bob Hawke. He made this speech at Lone Pine when he spoke about the Anzac spirit. In that recognition of the special meaning of Australian mateship, the self-recognition of their dependence upon one another, these Australians, by no means all of them born in Australia, drawn from every walk of life and different backgrounds, cast upon these hostile shores, there lay the genesis of the Anzac tradition. When I read those words, I just thought of the 1967 Socceroos. Mm-hmm. That's who they were. And Bob Hawke is articulating what he sees as his defining Australian quality, yet he refers almost to exactly what Ray's been telling us about, yet football's invisible as a part of that conversation. And a big part of that is this commercialization, and some people in some of their books have called it the Disneyfication of ANZAC. It's become this business, which is incredibly regrettable if that's the case. And the fact that soccer doesn't form a part of leading corporates, leading institutions, we don't have our hands on the till of the Australian government. We're not able to inject ourselves into this national debate. We can't tell the stories of Ray's team, the Socceroos of 67. We're not able to do that because we don't actually have the platform to be able to tell that story and embed it into the myth building that's happened. You know, and that's not to suggest that we should be ahead of the other sports. Not at all. But it's the fact that we need to be considered like every other Australian story. It's Fair Nation.
One of the aspects of the resetting of ANZAC was, culturally, was Peter Weir's film Gallipoli.
I repeat, the attack must proceed. I want you all to remember who you are.
Please come home.
The 10th Light Horse, men from Western Australia.
It was a very powerful film, and it made a strong argument about the perfidy of the British officers and, you know, sending Australian troops into suicide missions. And, you know, it's a movie that makes you quite angry when you watch it. It's quite a moving movie. But I realise that it's actually, it tells a few fibs. When we see the troops, the Western Australian troops gathered, you hear them all speaking, and they're speaking in Australian accents. And in my research, I realised that that wouldn't actually have been the case, because about a third of those troops would have had Scottish or English accents, because the very first wave of Western Australian volunteers were not overwhelmingly, but substantially British-born. And so many of those guys were, as we know, were soccer players. You know, the Geraldton boy I just read out, he played soccer in Geraldton. He was on the first boat to Gallipoli. And these people are absent in Peter Weir's film. And in fact, the only sport, apart from running, in Peter Weir's film is when they're kicking a footy on the beach at Gallipoli. When, you know, the culture of those soldiers would have been much more diverse. And, you know, as if you've read the book, you'll know that there was a game of soccer at Gallipoli.
Mm. Ray Butts, just to bring you back in, Australian football great, not sure if you've got any particular views off the back of those comments, but how have you viewed the Australian war narrative and particularly the legend of ANZAC over the last 53 years in an Australian context and football's place in that?
Well, I think it's been obvious by its absence, to be honest with you. You know, the only involvement I've ever had or ever seen is the tour that we had of Vietnam. I don't, to my knowledge, there hasn't been any other involvement whatsoever, and it's been just sadly missing in our game.
So have there been any commemorations, even within the football industry, within various federations, national, state federations?
But just on that point, David, I don't think it's – I think the broader point to be made here is that it's not for – this isn't about football promoting itself as being this great contributor to Australia's war history,
yep.
Okay? This is about why haven't the mainstream institutions of Australian life been telling that story side by side with other sports? And that's what we're trying to unpack here, is because it shouldn't be – for the local Newcastle Association or Football Victoria or whoever else to say, look at us, look how great we were, we contributed to the war effort. Because maybe it wasn't necessarily that good to contribute to the war effort, because a lot of awful things happen. So it's not about making a value judgment on that. What it's about saying is, as a nation, we have mythologized or created this myth around ANZAC, and we use it at every conceivable opportunity. You know, we're investing over $1 billion in a new Australian War Memorial. We treat the Anzac Day AFL clash as if it's the man landing on the moon. Yet we can't, within these institutions, find the smallest window to tell a story as powerful as Ray's and the Socceroos of 67. And that is the big challenge that Australia as a nation has. And that's, you know, speaks to how football has been systematically sidelined, delegitimized since 1918. Mm. Well before that, Ian, no doubt.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. There is one thing that that Adamstown does every year on Anzac Day. It has a Anzac Day game. I don't know if you go to that, Ray, but one of the Adamstown players was killed at Gallipoli, and I just forget his name at the moment, but I've been in discussions with John Connor and a few other people to try and get a medal struck in his honour for the, you know, the best on the ground on that game. So there are little things we can do, and, you know, maybe we can have a chat about that down the track too, Ray.
Yeah. Well, I'm not aware of that, and to be honest with you, and you know, I think that's fantastic if they do that. I know that there is a lot of association with the First War, and, you know, the guys from that went to the First War from the Newcastle area. You know, there's a lot of English miners here. My grandkids, or some of them, go to Dudley Primary School, which is a little village just outside Newcastle, and that primary school produced two VC winners. Now, I'm sure that both of those guys coming from a little mining village in the Hunter would have been soccer players as well. Yeah. And you've got me intrigued about that now, and I'm going to sort of dig into that and just see if they did play.
Yeah.
I want to get your final summations. It's been a fascinating chat. I want to start with you, Ray Bartz, Socceroos great. Now, I guess just your closing remarks. Whose responsibility is it to properly recognise the feats and sheer bravery of this Australian squad that went into the war zone to play football and win this tournament, which was the Socceroos' first international tournament win?
Well, I don't know if it's anybody's responsibility to, you know, to chase a medal or whatever for the players, but speaking on behalf of the players, we were honoured to represent our country. We were honoured to be there and to support the war effort and support the soldiers over there. And if anything does come out of it, you know, it's not something we would expect, but if we did receive some sort of recognition from it, we would be very humble to accept that, and I'm sure, especially on behalf of the effort that Johnny Warren put in to reward the players accordingly.
Ian Sison, how does football claim its rightful place within the legend of Anzac?
Well, we just start remembering. I mean, it's almost as simple as that. We start remembering, but we remember that term I used before, our ordinariness. We remember how we were just simply a part of something that's seen to be an important moment or important moments in Australian history. The problems with the 67 Vietnam game are the same as the problems of the Second World War, the same as the problems of the First World War and even the Boer War. We need to remember. It's our responsibility as a game to remember, but it's also Australia's responsibility as a culture, as a society, to remember its whole stories properly. So, you know, it's not just our responsibility, but it is also our responsibility.
John Didlitzer, the series author, I'll leave the final words to you.
Yeah, I like Ian's point, is that this isn't about football having to assume responsibility to propagate its role in war. It's about testing the validity of Australia's conversation in dealing with this huge national myth and football's absence from it. You know, and I think from my perspective, the hyper-commercialisation of Anzac in recent decades means that a sport like football with no institutional grounding finds it incredibly challenging to compete for oxygen to tell these stories. Yet, you know, having listened to Ray again and having read so much literature from that time, you know, assessed against any conventional understanding as to what Anzac might mean, you know, selflessness, mateship, commitment, soccer is a sport not found wanting. It's more than done its bit through this journey. And the fact that the Saigon Socceroos, Yerimpil, Caledonia don't stand shoulder to shoulder with Essendon and Collingwood says a lot about how football soccer is perceived within Australia and the fact that it is disenfranchised in many ways.
Boys, it's been a fascinating chat. A particularly big thank you to Ian Sison and the great Ray Bartz for joining us to reflect on The Legend of Anzac. Remember, it is a 10-part series available on Optus Sport platforms, both the podcast and the written chapters. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you again very soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.